Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the first AZMcast of 2018. It's January, and we're deep into flu season, and I know many people are expecting a flu episode, probably because I told you that was what we were going to do, but you're going to have to wait just a bit longer into February. But don't worry, the way our flu vaccine has been working, you'll still have plenty of flu for months and months to come. Instead, we're going to try to help our residents get prepped for their in-training exam next month with a broad survey of renal and genitourinary emergencies. We'll be covering kidneys, bladder, urethra, penis, scrotum, all with the decorum and professionalism that you've come to expect from our podcast. And if you believe that, you're probably a first-time listener. So thanks for listening, and welcome to January's AZMcast. So, Brian, what you got over there?
Oh, Aaron, this is a textbook.
Textbook? Yeah. One of them Tintin Alleys?
One of them red, black, and white Tintin Alleys.
So what do you do with those?
I used to read them. I'm not sure what I do with it anymore. It sits on my shelf and collects dust until once a year when we do this episode.
That's right. So, you know, eventually it paid off, you know. Mine is somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where, but I know that it's somewhere in my house. It's probably holding down something that needs to be glued together, you know, because I'm out of vice grips or something.
It works very well for flattening papers that the kids have wrinkled up.
Very cool. So you were telling me about when you bought this that you've read Tintin Alleys three times, which is probably why you're a good doctor.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I did. I read it when I was in Iraq running a detention camp, and that was really a lot of fun. So between rectals on patients looking for foreign bodies, I would open Tintin Alley and try to take myself away. And then in our residency program, we actually read Tintin Alley twice. We did it in a year and a half, and then reread it again the second year and a half, your residency. We did quizzes every week. So
for those of you that think it's impossible to read Tintin Alleys, Brian has done the impossible three times. It is possible. And if you do that, then you don't have to worry about all the other stuff. You can start going into all the, you know, crazy aspects of big pharma and, you know, CDC and all the other politicking.
Once you read it, you can start to truly put on your space cadet hat and start to fly where no man wants to go.
So, since we've got it open, we are going to get you prepped for your in-training exam, as we have done for the last 5 years. And we are going to start with renal and probably make it from the tip of the nephron to the tip of the
penis.
I was going to say urethra, but sure. So we're going to work our way out. So we're going to start just by talking about some high-yield stuff that we think is likely to be on your in-training exam. It's likely to be referenced somewhere on your test. So it's just good stuff that if you've heard about this, go, oh, yeah, I know that. But if you've never heard this, you probably would do well to read up on this. And then because we can't just talk about book stuff, we'll probably throw in some clinical stuff as well, and maybe even some weird stories.
Right. We'll try to say if this is probably more today's practice, but don't think that way for the boards. Remember, the boards are and the in-service is a little bit behind where what we may be doing in everyday practice.
That's correct. So we're going to start at the nephrons, or the nephrons, depending on who taught you renal physiology. So we're going to start with just the glomeruli and what they're supposed to do, and sleep.
hey, Farron Arterial. material.
So essentially what you need to know is the testing aspect of these things going wrong. So the kidney is your filter, right? It filters out your blood, and when your filter starts to go, then you start over-filtering or under-filtering stuff. Essentially what I want you to remember is the difference between nephrotic and nephritic. So nephrotic syndrome is a constellation of where you basically have loss of protein, which makes you edematous, which makes you have higher blood pressure. These are kind of the nephrotic syndrome essentially will give you foamy urine because you have lots of protein in your urine. And nephrotic syndrome is not something that we have to work up in the ED necessarily. However, it is something we need to recognize. Patients with new onset nephrotic syndrome, especially in the peds ED, this is often something we jump on because we want them admitted and we want to figure out what the source is so that we can try to head this off. So what you'll see when you've got nephrotic syndrome, I don't want you to know exactly how much protein you need to measure out, but you'll see a good amount of protein. This is not like trace protein that you get from being dehydrated. This is not a little bit of protein that you get from working out too hard. This is like 3 to 4+, lots of protein on a dipstick, okay? And they will have otherwise normal kidney function, but they'll have protein in their urine. So this is the foamy beer that you'll see when the kid kind of throws the urine cup along the bar. It's got a good head on it. You have to blow it off before you can actually run the urine test. That's nephrotic syndrome.
Yeah. Think of a urine that comes back with protein, swelling, maybe acute or maybe chronic.
On the other hand, you've got nephritic syndrome, which always has some red cells and maybe some white cells along with it. So when you get a urine and it's got red cells and white cells, in the ER, you're always thinking, this is somebody with pyelo that's giving me a dirty catch. Or, you know, maybe it's that patient who came in with a headache that had a urine ordered for some reason, and she's on her menses, and now we've got a dirty catch. You can often blow these off in the ED. But the constellation's a little bit different when you're thinking of nephritic syndrome. So that is going to be some of these features, but it's more going to have hypertension. You're going to have more signs of an acute kidney injury with nephritic syndrome often. You'll have red cells. You'll often have white cells as well. So be on the lookout for that. You may have reds and whites as a mix, but man, they really don't have dysuria symptoms. Instead, they've got symptoms of hypertension, and they've got edema, and they've got signs of an acute kidney injury. This is usually something a little more intrinsic. So this is more maybe your fruit beer or something that's got a little bit of red to it, you know. And you can mix these both, and you can have a heady fruity beer that will give you a nephrotic syndrome. And thus, all urine has come back to beer where it started. So, but a lot of what we see is more going to be just hematuria. Brian, what do you do for those cases where you've gotten the urine and you've got some microscopic hematuria and you don't really know why?
I think it depends on what you're looking in the urine for hematuria for. If you think it was a kidney stone, you have a little bit of hematuria, that's an easy concept. If you have someone, you got a urine, maybe because they had just had some general belly pain and you checked a urine because you're worried about a kidney stone or infection, and you don't see any white cells, you can have an acute cystitis that's a hemorrhagic cystitis, and you could have a lot of red blood cells in that. But if you have just a couple red blood cells, like an asymptomatic hematuria, those a lot of times will just be followed up in the outpatient. With the repeat urine in a couple weeks, it doesn't mean that they have something super wrong, but they should be followed up in a close monitored basis.
Yeah, it's not something you want to ignore. It's not something you just kind of blow off. You do tell the patient, you know, just so you know, you had a very small amount of blood in your urine, which can be very common. Usually all we do is have to recheck it in a week or so and see if it's still there. The most common cause for this is some kind of, you know, unknown kidney trauma. I guess we can't know that if it was unknown trauma. but some kind of incidental trauma that caused a little bit of blood. What you want to distinguish between is that and the nephritic syndrome, which is going to be more persistent and have some other symptoms that go with it.
Right. So if you have someone who they're giving you that's clinically appearing well, you know, normal vital signs, no swelling in their legs, they're peeing okay, and the urine has a little bit of red blood cells, an outpatient follow-up for a repeat urinalysis in 2 to 4 weeks would be a reasonable answer in what you're going to do next with that patient.
Now, that's to delineate between microscopic hematuria and gross hematuria. If they're peeing frank blood, that needs to be worked up a bit more. And usually what I'm looking for is, first of all, which anticoagulant are you on, sir or ma'am? Or I'm asking, you know, are you on your cycle right now? But then you start thinking of either kidney stones or some kind of structural kidney disease or cancer. If they've got symptoms, that'll hopefully direct you in the way you need to go. If they've got flank pain and fever, then yeah, probably that's your source. But if they don't have symptoms, that's usually pretty ominous. And I've had far too many prostate, bladder, or kidney cancers that I've diagnosed by just asymptomatic hematuria.
Right. If you have hematuria that's gross, I think the big things you're going to be asking yourself, is this a trauma patient? That would be a cause of gross hematuria. Is this an infection patient, either a hemorrhagic cystitis or a pilo that just is presenting with a lot more blood? Is this a cancer of some kind? So like Aaron said, anywhere along the tract can give you a painless hematuria. Is this a kidney stone? Those are probably the four major things that I would think about for cancer. So trauma, stone, infection, or cancer are probably your four causes of gross hematuria that you want to start to think about.
So those are probably the biggest things you'll see on the urinalysis that pertain specifically to the kidneys. Is going to be reds, whites, protein. That's going to tell you a whole lot about how the kidneys are doing. Most of the other stuff, you know, we'll get nitrites, we'll talk about UTIs, we'll look for ketones, which is generally more a sign of your serum than an actual kidney issue, but pay attention to those because we don't often find somebody that comes back with a lot of protein or a lot of mix of reds and whites without other symptoms. So think that this might actually be a glomerular problem that potentially you could head off before it starts to turn into something worse, like an acute kidney injury.
That sounds bad.
It's acute.
And it's part of the kidney, which is what we're talking about today, I think.
And it used to be called acute renal failure, but no one's allowed to fail anymore. Every kidney gets a trophy and an orange slice.
It's just an injury.
They can bounce back, and I hope that they will. I'm really pulling for these kidneys. So acute kidney injuries are kind of separated into pre-renal, intrinsic renal, and post-renal. So the pre-renal ones are going to be the ones everybody's pretty familiar with, which is low perfusion, whether from hypovolemia, whether from some kind of shock state, or maybe poor cardiac output. Their kidneys are taking the hit. This is the classic CHF patient that comes in and gets admitted to the hospital, and the cardiologist says, they're too wet, dry them out. And the nephrologist says, no, they're too dry, you know, give them some more fluids. And they go back and forth and back and forth. The poor patient is caught in the middle. So these are patients that just aren't having enough flow. Maybe it's medications, maybe it's chronic NSAIDs, but pre-renal is generally treated with fluids, and depending on the other constellation of symptoms, it may or may not require someone to come into the hospital as long as you can fix them. Usually what I've found is that the more comorbidities you have, the easier it is for you to get an acute kidney injury and the harder it is to bounce back. If you're otherwise a healthy 19-year-old who has been drinking beer and out at the pool all day here in Tucson, you may get an acute kidney injury, and a couple liters of fluids will help you bounce back pretty quickly.
Yeah. The three main classes, the most common will probably be is decreased volume. So decreased volume is one. The second one would be decreased cardiac output, and that like is what Aaron's saying. Heart failure patient, maybe it's a sepsis patient, someone who's just not pumping enough blood flow to the kidney. And the third would be some vascular component. So say you had a renal artery stenosis or an emboli that's decreasing blood flow, you could get a pre-renal, but that is a much more rare cause. And we usually treat based on what the patient's presenting with. So it looks, if the patient looks like they're having an MI and has a bump creatinine, it's probably the MI not perfusing the kidney. If they give you the story that the patient has been out in the heat all day, it's probably a pre-renal that's from a decreased volume. So your treatment of these a lot of times is based on what everything else is. This is just kind of another symptom that you're adding in to how you're going to approach this patient.
Now, if you look at your BUN creatinine and it gives you some idea that this patient has taken a hit, we've traditionally used ratios to determine if this is something acute or something chronic. Now, in somebody who's otherwise healthy, it's probably going to be acute because they're otherwise healthy. In someone who's got a chronic kidney injury, chronic kidney insufficiency, again, not failure, insufficiency.
They're just not sufficient.
Which still makes me sad.
Then in these patients, you can still have a creatinine of 2, but a BUN of 80 and say, nah, that's got to be acute on chronic. So, Brian, what was the ratio you were taught?
20 to 1. So 20 to 1 BUN to creatinine. And the other thing you want to think about if you get a high ratio would be a GI bleed. So if you're getting something maybe 30 to 1, you know, we talk about ratios with something. So, hey, you see 20 to 1, oh, but it's 30 to 1. Think about GI bleed, which would also give you an acute kidney injury from a pre-renal cause.
So the chronic ones are going to give you less BUN for a high creatinine, showing that they've had trouble filtering their creatinine for quite some time and they've just gotten used to it. So the creatinine is not as scary as the BUN. An elevated creatinine isn't going to kill you. It's everything that you can or can't filter because of your elevated creatinine that's going to kill you. So in trying to figure out if this acute kidney injury is pre-renal, intrinsic renal, or post-renal, sometimes this can be a value as you look at the other factors. There is this wonderful formula called AFINA, and we're going to tell you how to calculate it right now. You go to www.mdcalc.com and insert whatever the numbers are that they require, and there you go.
Yeah, they're not going to ask you to order a urine sodium or whatever other things you need for AFINA, but this is something that it may be talked about, but you will not have to calculate AFINA on the test.
Not for the test. Now, in real life, it does help. And in real life, if you get a urine on a patient and find that they've got an acute kidney injury and hyponatremia, you know what? It helps the rest of the team to order that stuff. And I'll tell you what, if you already call them and tell them that you've ordered that stuff, they're probably not going to fight your admission as hard because they know that you're somebody who took the time to calculate a frickin' FINA. Man, you must be a really good doc, even if it's just one of those things that you do. So it can be useful, and they like to get that before you flood them with 3 liters of fluids because sometimes it's hard to figure out. So intrinsic renal disease, this is a glomerulonephritis gone bad. This is acute interstitial nephritis or tubular necrosis, something like myoglobin that gets built up from rhabdo. This is why we flush these patients out hardcore. This is other kinds of toxins or medications that have built up. This is vascular issues. So maybe you've got a renal artery stenosis or a renal vein clot or something that's impairing your perfusion to your kidney, and the kidney itself is just frankly dying. So these are things that we consider while we're looking for the AKI. Now, I wanted to talk briefly about different constellations of acute kidney injury that will come up, and you will see these at some point, and it's important to recognize these patterns. When you check these patients, you'll see that their platelets are low, and the most common one is ITP. I know this is a discussion of kidneys, but it is important to be able to ferret these out to see that ITP is going to have completely normal kidney function. Everything is fine. It's just the platelets themselves that are low. Versus TTP and hemolytic uremic syndrome, where you're also going to see evidence of hemolysis, and you're going to see that acute kidney injury. So sometimes you'll look at this and say, wow, they're anemic. They need blood. Man, their kidneys are trash. They need fluids. Man, their platelets are low. They need more platelets. And if you step back and see, wait a minute, their
red cells are low, their kidneys suck, and they need platelets, they may have one of these things, then you can actually intervene in a much different fashion to save these patients' lives, because especially for TTP, the treatment for this is actually plasmapheresis, which I've had to do twice before in the ED. And it's crazy when it actually happens. But you need to recognize these patterns. So when you see an acute kidney injury, look for other abnormalities and try to put these patterns together as a unifying diagnosis if you're able to. The other reason being is that if you've got ITP, which has normal function, and you give them platelets, you're just going to burn it up. If you give the other two platelets, you're going to add fuel to the fire and increase the microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, or MAHA, and really make the whole inflammatory system go even crazier, out of control. You can make these patients potentially sicker. All right. Last up, we're going to talk about post-obstructive acute kidney injury. So this is the poor old guy that's got an enormous bladder, and you can feel it at his ribs, and he has not peed in 2 days, and he's really got to pee. You can back that up enough so that he actually gets backflow into the kidneys and reflux that causes an acute kidney injury. I've actually seen a kid before that had a complete phimosis. He wasn't able to pee, and he had been that way where he'd had like maybe a little pinhole that shot whichever direction he wanted to pee, a little balloon at the end of the foreskin, and he could not pee, and he had grade 4 hydronephrosis and actually had an acute kidney injury that we had to call a surgeon down and do a dorsal slit in the ED to place a catheter on this kid. So remember, you got to get stuff out as well. If you get these kidneys very waterlogged, then they're not going to function as well. They got to be able to take blood flow in and to put urine out, or else they're going to fail. Anything else about acute kidney injury?
No. Usually the treatment you're going to ask is for is a Foley catheter, and maybe you're going to check a bladder volume. Those may be, you know, what is the next step in a patient that presents with a mass in their lower abdomen and inability to urinate, an older male. Just if they ask you like most common things, the most common cause of pre-hospital kidney injury would be a pre-renal cause. The most common hot cause of an in-hospital would be an intrinsic renal cause. And post-renal are rarer than the other two. That's the least common cause.
And I'm going to say again, from most common things, most common cause for hemolytic uremic syndrome is the E. coli 0157:H7. That's usually found in ground beef that's been mixed from lots of different cows. So this is one of the reasons why we don't treat bloody diarrhea in children, is they are more prone to it. Data doesn't show a solid correlation, but it's enough that we just don't do it. We kind of let it run its course, and we'd rather just hydrate them until we're certain it's not one of those.
Yeah, the hemolytic uremic syndromes, most of the ones I've seen are usually some GI illness, which is one of these exposures from some GI bug that then you start seeing some sequelae.
And hemolytic uremic syndrome is the most common reason for acute dialysis in kids, more than any of the other reasons that we have. So if you have one of these kids, they've got the potential to get sick in a hurry. Speaking of dialysis, so we've got two methods for dialysis. There's usually one question on the end training every year about peritoneal dialysis, and then there's a question.
It's in the stomach. That's a stomach dialysis. That's the answer.
So they've got a PD cath. They usually will have fluid that dwells in the abdomen, and they'll use the peritoneum as a membrane to be able to flow in and out. So we just had one of these patients the other day, and he knew his dialysis regimen, and we were trying to get it set up, but then he ended up being fine, so we sent him home to quickly do his dialysis at home so that we didn't hurt him
trying to figure out peritoneal dialysis.
But the issue that usually comes up is that these patients can get infected, and that's often the question they'll ask you on the end training exam is what are they prone to? And it's very commonly the same stuff that everybody else is prone to when they've got an indwelling catheter. Plus you get the risk of gram negatives that go along with it.
Right. They're going to ask you something somewhere on the line of a spontaneous bacterial peritonitis question that you would hear about in a cirrhotic patient. But these patients, in a sense, have given themselves an acidic fluid in their belly because they're injecting, letting it do its water exchanges, electrolyte exchanges, and then pulling it off and re-injecting. So a tender belly, fever, those kind of things, that's what you want to be worried about in a peritoneal dialysis patient.
Yep. So think about staph, strep, and all the gram negatives that are kind of around your intestines that might leak out. Now, hemodialysis is going to be very different. So hemodialysis patients are still prone to staph and strep because they've got an indwelling catheter, unless they've got the VASCath. So emergencies related to these are usually bleeding complications. They'll come in with a giant clamp on, and usually it was enough that they were still able to finish their dialysis, I find.
Right.
Before they got a headache and right after they paid their bill. And then they come into the ED with a giant clamp on. So when these things bleed, they bleed like crazy. So, Brian, when you have any patient, let alone a bleeding patient, come in with a fistula, what's kind of your exam for the fistula? What do you look at for these patients?
Yeah, the first thing, with anyone with a fistula, you want to know, number one, where it is. So, because you, right, we don't put a blood pressure cuff or the triage vitals, things like that. Once you find the fistula, you're going to look at it, just do it like any exam, a general inspection. You know, if they have it covered because they're bleeding, you're going to eventually have to look at that. I then will, after I look at it, I'm going to feel, right? What are you feeling for? A thrill. Why? Because it's fun. No. But you're feeling for the thrill.
You never tell the patient you're feeling for thrills.
As you're stroking and caressing their arms. So you want to feel a thrill. It's right. It's that constant weird sensation that you really don't get anywhere else in the body. But it's in these dialysis catheter or fistulas that you're going to feel that. So you feel for a thrill. If you cannot feel a thrill, that is concerning. Also, I try to actually depress the catheter a little bit, like a vessel, just kind of bounce it. Not the catheter, the fistula. But you want to see if there has some compressibility. Why? Because if I'm not feeling a thrill, I want to see if there's a thrombus or it's starting to get hard. Because a harder, like a thrombus, or if it's starting to calcify, that's concerning because they may eventually have some more complications when they go for their next dialysis. So if I feel a thrill, that's number one. If I see it's not bleeding, that's number two. And we're pretty much done at that point. If I can compress it, even better. If I look at it and it's covered and I'm going to have to check for bleeding, I'm going to down my personal protective equipment, that's the first thing you do with any of this stuff, and then I'm going to slowly uncover and try to find the exact site, because a lot of times it's not a big hole, it's a tiny little hole, but this is under such pressure that it just bleeds like stink. And so if you can identify the exact spot as opposed to the huge bandage someone put on it, that seems to be much easier. And then the question is going to be, what do you do with that? So if there's a tiny little hole, what's the next thing you're going to do? Well, I'm going to hold direct pressure, number one, two, and three. And then number four is going to be, I'm going to call for a vascular surgeon who is not going to yell at me with what I'm going to do. Now, if you're out in the middle of nowhere, you can put other things in it, right? You could do a small, like a staple. If you just think it's a skin tear over it, you could throw a figure of eight stitch in. What you don't want to do is throw a deep figure of eight or tie off this vessel. That may make people very unhappy who spent time harvesting and then putting this anastomosis together to allow it to graft. So you have to make your decision on how much. If I can just put a little finger pressure on it, it controls the bleeding, maybe I'll have the patient do that. And we'll just hold it and wait for someone to come out. If it's bleeding like crap, you got to make that decision.
And then these are all the practical things that you'll do. And I agree with Brian. The first most important thing to do is direct pressure. So not heaping tons of bandage for the patient to bleed into, but direct pressure over the puncture wound. And then the answer on the test, once you've done all this other stuff for reversal of the heparin they were given, is probably going to be protamine sulfate.
Correct. And if they have other blood thinners, then you can also consider reversal. Rarely do I end up giving these patients platelets. I don't find that's ever useful. And then you can think about other causes. If they had a trauma, right, that'd be a totally different thing. If someone had a knife wound to their fistula and it's transected, you know, that's a different story, right? This is a different patient, not just the little puncture wound that's bleeding.
So going from kidney injury to kidney pain. So flank pain is commonly what people will present with. They won't come in and say, "Doctor, I feel my kidney is failing." They'll say, "Doctor, my back hurts." And the flank, I find, gets larger depending on like what day I'm having. It's like the flank goes all the way from like the buttock all the way up to the shoulder blade sometimes, and it still ends up being stones. So the two things that we think of with flank pain, it's usually a pretty easy differential. It's kidney stones or kidney infection. Once you've ruled out the other dangerous things, it's not a AAA that's ruptured. It's not an aortic dissection. It's not osteo or discitis in an IV drug user. You know, flank pain's usually pretty simple. There's not a whole lot back there. So they come in and they say, "Doc, it hurts right here." And what do? You pound them with your fist over the area that hurts. And they say, "Ow." And you go, "Yeah, that does hurt. Wow." And you ask for a urine. So the two things we're looking for kidney stones or kidney infection. And really, all of that's going to be in the urine. I find it's most helpful to give the patient the cup and to say, "Why don't you go try to pee for me right now?" "Oh, I couldn't." "Oh, I think you could. Come on, let's walk over there. I bet you can get something." Otherwise, that will take you 3 hours to get that urine. I can almost guarantee you.
Yeah, I usually tell them, "I just need a teaspoon of urine. That's all I need." I give them a really low volume.
A teaspoon? That's going to be really hard to hit.
No. I have them pee on the teaspoon, pour it in, and then re-pee on that teaspoon because I want the second clean catch, Aaron. I don't want that first. So 2 teaspoons. I guess I'm playing a game of spoons with these patients. No, I just tell them I want a little bit, and I agree with Aaron. You got to walk them right to the bathroom and get a look at that urine.
And you have to describe to them what a clean catch is. I heard someone say that it's impossible for any patient to truly give a clean catch urine because they're just not able to. And I think they do the best that they can. I don't think we need to cath everybody. But there are times where I'm more aggressive. Certainly in kids that aren't potty trained, they need a catheterized specimen to know it's coming from the bladder or else it's just not any good. If you've got a woman who's on her menses and you're really concerned that it might be a kidney stone or a kidney infection, you probably need to do a cath urine. If you've got an elderly patient, you're probably not going to want to wait until they'll pee. So there are good times for a cath urine. I find the most helpful thing a catheter does is scare the pee out of people. And I bring in the red rubber one or like an OG, you know, and say, "Well, you know, if you can't pee, I guess we're going to have to try this. Oh, nope, suddenly got to go." So works every time. So in kind of looking up the flank pain, this is pretty simple. Fever, back pain, vomiting, you now have pyelonephritis. You should see whites, you should see nitrites, you should see leukocyte esterase, all of these wonderful predictors if you're on the test.
Correct.
In real life, you kind of got to...
Any combination of those with clinical symptoms you'll treat. But on the test, they're going to give you a dirty urine. They're not going to make it subtle.
All right. Now, if you've got a patient that's got all red cells, generally they are writhing all over the place. They can't get comfortable in bed, and they're a patient that's going to give you hematuria. They're going to give you frank blood, or they're going to give you microscopic hematuria. So the old way of treating these, we used to get not even a CAT scan. Before that, we would do the KUB.
Woo-hoo.
Which stands for kidney, ureter, and bladder. You had to have a honking stone for it to show up on the KUB. Now the KUB is for finding stool, which I still don't understand.
Which has no evidence for finding. Don't get me going on that one.
It totally finds the poop. My issue with it is I can't tell the difference between how much poop that kid is supposed to have and how much they have now to make a diagnosis of constipation. So we've progressed beyond that, and we started doing CAT scans. And then we realized, you know, that's a lot of radiation for not a lot of intervention. So most urologists will say if it's less than 5 millimeters, it'll pass on its own. If it's greater than 10 millimeters, it's going to need some help. And somewhere between 5 and 10 millimeters is, we don't know. So for those patients, we generally try pain control, NSAIDs, especially ketorolac seems to work incredibly well for these patients. We give them a strainer so that they can go home and keep their little pet rock, bring it to their doctor's office, and figure out what it is. Most of these are going to be calcium oxalate stones. That's the most common one. But some of them will be struvite stones, which which is associated with a Proteus infection. Uric acid stones make you more concerned for stuff like leukemia or gout, where you've got a lot of cell turnover. And then cystine stones are incredibly rare. You have to have cystinuria in order to have cystine stones. But that's why they try to figure them out. Most all of them, I think about 90% of them, are going to be calcium oxalate stones.
And the rare one they sometimes like to throw on the boards is an Indinavir stone, which is patients who are on HIV and they're on Indinavir. And those stones can be radiolucent even on a CT scan. So if you see hydro on a CT scan that stops, or they're giving you an HIV patient and there's some blood, but they can't see a stone, they may still have a stone. So just think about that.
And that's where ultrasound has come in, that we're actually looking for the secondary signs of the stone and using our clinical judgment to diagnose kidney stone. If you see mild hydronephrosis, great. If you see mild to moderate hydronephrosis, okay, maybe a little more concerned. Maybe enough to get a scan and look at the size of the stone if they've not had them before. If you see severe hydronephrosis, they definitely need a scan because they're going to need the extra help. Usually when these stones obstruct, they'll be in a couple different places, the most common one being the UVJ, the ureterovesicular junction, right as the ureter intersects with the bladder. And then the UPJ, the ureteropelvic junction, just as it's coming out of the kidney, is the second most common one.
And then the third place it will be is where the ureter crosses the psoas. So those are kind of your three places that it's usually going to catch. And obstruction is hard to tell, right? You can have a small stone that really obstructs, or a big stone that somehow they have a big ureter and it's getting around. So all these tests that we're using are really, you know, in a sense, giving us a little information, but the urine analysis is probably your best test, because if you have red cells and a good history, it's probably a stone regardless of what they have. But your testing modalities now are going to be ultrasound and CT. Based on those results, may determine what you do next with the patient.
So moving on from stones to infection, Brian, you've given some great talks about the utility of the urinalysis.
Just everyone who happens to walk into the ED, would you like to get on your soapbox?
Not just a urinalysis, you have to culture them too, Aaron, because the culture, number one, is very, it pays for itself all the time. And so you culture them, you do a urinalysis on everyone, right? Toenail, fungus, urinalysis. I got a sore throat, urinalysis. But in a sense, what we really should be looking for in patients, and we're starting to see this nationwide, right? There's asymptomatic bacteria rates varying in different countries. And some places, because of just the natural flora of that area, it can be as high as 40 to 50% of patients will have asymptomatic bacteria all the time. It's just their natural flora that lives in their bladder. Other places, maybe less than 2%. So you have to take that into consideration when we're doing testing on patients. And what you really care about is not, is there bacteria in their urine? You're concerned if that bacteria is causing an infection that could then hurt the patient in some way. So that's really what we're looking for. We're looking for someone with clinical symptoms and in a state where that clinical symptom is now going to cause them disease. And that disease can start with just a simple bladder infection, which may be very benign and easily treatable and can occur multiple times in patients. Or if it starts to ascend and then go to a kidney infection, a pyelonephritis we talked about with flank pain, or eventually a systemic infection, which would then be, you know, we can see with sepsis. So these can progress and can be dangerous, and at the same time, they can be very mild and benign in patients.
And a lot of patients will clear them on their own. But when they come to the ED, we generally assume that they're not going to clear them on their own and they're looking for antibacterial therapy. So we'll give them antibiotics, and depending on their symptoms, you've got a constellation of antibiotics you can use. I think the important things that the in-training exam or the boards may kind of pick out is, do you know which bacteria you're treating? So the most common ones are going to be E. coli, far and above.
About 80%. Yeah. So this is, when Aaron says far and above, we really mean far and above. Everything else is less than 20%.
And then you've got Klebsiella, Proteus, some of these other gram-negatives that are all going to be treated with similar drugs. And you've got one antibiotic in particular with nitrofurantoin that works by collecting in the bladder and concentrating itself until it chokes out the bacteria and kills it. That is probably the one antibiotic that won't be good for pyelonephritis because it's not going to affect the kidneys. It's going to only work for simple cystitis. Once you've actually got pyelonephritis and the kidneys are involved, you got to pick something different, something like trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole or some kind of a cephalosporin
or ciprofloxacin.
Exactly.
Yeah, nitrofurantoin, it's one indication or its main indication you will use. There may be a second, you just don't use it that often, is acute cystitis. And that should be your first drug because cultures, if you look at cultures most places, the bugs are still sensitive to nitrofurantoin for acute cystitis. With trimethoprim sulfa, most places it works for pyelo, but if you start to use it, it gets resistance real fast. Cipro is probably the long-standing one, but getting some resistance in places. And then you can use third-generation cephalosporins as well. They may also induce resistance. And then if you have pregnant patients, some things you may want to think about is usually something like cefalexin, or if it's just a cystitis, you can also use nitrofurantoin, but maybe not Cipro, maybe not trimethoprim sulfa in your pregnant patients. And duration will also be longer, too. So pyelonephritis is going to be 10 to 14 days, whereas a cystitis, maybe 3 days of Cipro or 7 days of nitrofurantoin.
And I want to make a plug for the evaluation of UTI in infants. If you are doing a cath for a kid, you should culture it. Because with kids, they pee frequently. They don't hold it until they're potty trained. And so they'll just pee stuff out. And their urinalysis might not be that impressive. And yet they would still have a cystitis. So for that reason, we implore you to order the urinalysis with the complete microscopy, with the culture, no matter what, because A, you went through all the trouble of cathing this kid, you might as well get the full test. You wouldn't do an LP and not get the culture, right? And B is because you might not see what you want on first glance of just the urinalysis.
For adults, most of these do not need culture. So Aaron's talking about a specific population, really the young kids that you're looking at. But even, say, teenagers, most of the time you probably don't need a urine culture. Is that fair to say?
Unless I cath them.
Unless you cath them, yeah. Well, if you're cathing a 13-year-old, that's a different story.
Yeah, a lot of primary care doctors will just have a patient call in, hey, I think I've got a UTI again, and call them antibiotics in over the phone. But we in the ED don't have that continuity, which is why we get a little more aggressive on this stuff. Now, it turns out that a UTI is not the only thing that can make it burn when you pee. Who knew? There are other sources you kind of need to consider. So complicated UTIs, men should really not get UTIs because of the distance from point A to point B compared to women at the tip of the urethral meatus all the way back to the bladder. Elderly men, I would be more concerned about, especially for something like prostatitis. So if the prostate gets infected, you'll have urinary symptoms. They'll have dysuria because it does burn when they pee. But you'll also get some bowel symptoms. You'll get pain upon bowel movements as well. And oftentimes they can get pretty sick from prostatitis.
And very high fevers. They may just have a non-specific pain in their lower abdomen that they can't localize because there really isn't a place that people push on the prostate on a regular basis. So I'll leave that open. So prostatitis, if you're concerned about, you know, a guy looks like he has a urinary tract infection, but it's just low back pain, and he looks kind of sick and is having high fevers, you may consider prostatitis. Sometimes imaging is indicated in these patients. A CT scan of the abdomen pelvis, really the pelvis is where you're going to be looking, can show stranding or signs of infection in the prostate as well.
And the rectal exam is really going to be where it's at, of doing the rectal exam, pressing on the prostate, and seeing if it hurts. Now, I have heard, and Brian, I'd appreciate your input on this medical myth, that you don't want to press on the prostate if they've got acute prostatitis, because then you're going to push bacteria all over and they're going to get septic and shocky and die on you.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. So, as in so many of these myths, it's a clinical exam finding. I mean, you're just pushing on the prostate, and they talk about a boggy prostate. I don't know if I've truly felt a boggy prostate, like you're walking across a cranberry bog or something. But I have felt, you know, it's just softer. It's not that hard plum. It's like a really old plum that probably needs to be thrown outside.
In older people, you think of the same bacteria. Older men, you think of the same bacteria that would cause UTI, the predominant one being E. coli. In younger men, you think more of STIs. So that's what's going to give them the same thing with urethritis. So we're almost in our entire travel outside of the urinary tract. We're to urethritis. So urethritis, more likely in men, going to be from a sexually transmitted infection, namely chlamydia, gonorrhea. So when it burns when they pee and they pee for you and you've got, you know, 15 whites in the urine but everything else looks fine, I consider, you know, maybe we should test you for chlamydia as well, because that's more likely than that you have a UTI at age 24.
Right. And you, for the boards, they like this. Somehow there's a discriminant age of age 35. That at age 35, men stop having sex and somehow stop getting sexually transmitted infections. So I guess 35 or less, think more STDs. And 35 or older, think about something else. And they even, you know, what's interesting is, right, we're talking about urethritis, but epididymitis orchitis, somehow it's a different bacteria at age 35 in the guidelines and everything. It's fabulous. So I've passed 35, so obviously I can't get a sexually transmitted infection anymore, which is good. I'll tell my wife that. But think about this. So in all aspects, what you're really looking for, right, high-risk behavior in a younger male with UTI symptoms, think a sexually transmitted infection.
All right, Brian, I'm going to describe some penises for you.
All right.
You tell me what's wrong with them, okay?
Too short. Long.
Micropenis.
All right. So vesicular lesions around the urethral meatus that make it painful to urinate.
Sounds like a herpes virus, with the vesicular lesions sometimes even being blistered or just seeing the ulcer because the actual tip of the blister has gone away.
All right. You've got an ulcerated lesion somewhere on the penis that when you palpate it is not painful.
Sounds like syphilis, but this is not masquerading, right?
Nope. This actually is syphilis. So this is primary syphilis, the chancre. Not to be confused with the ulcerated lesion somewhere on the penis that is painful, which is
chancroid.
Chancroid, Haemophilus drusii or something. And that requires antibiotic treatment.
That requires antibiotics.
And syphilis is penicillin. Mm-hmm. Spirochetes are the dumbest bacteria in the history of the world. They've never become resistant to bacteria.
They're still smarter than us because it's still around. We've found ways to kill it. We just can't find ways to stop passing it. So. The other one that comes up a lot is lymphogranuloma venereum. So that's a chlamydial disease where they get a painless ulcer followed by inguinal lymphadenopathy. And that inguinal lymphadenopathy often has pus in it. So that's going to be treated with excision of that suppurative lymph node, and you treat like you're going to for chlamydia. So we're going to go all the way to the tip of the penis, foreskin problems. So balanoposthitis. So balano is the head of the penis. The
glands.
And posth is the foreskin. So if you have an inflamed glands and foreskin, you get balanoposthitis. So this is real common in young babies. This is essentially a diaper rash, and it's treated like a diaper rash. A lot of people I see want to give antibiotics to it. It's not usually a bacterial infection. It's almost always a yeast infection and is treated with some kind of antifungal like clotrimazole. You pull back the head of you pull back the foreskin as much as you can without causing pain. Put a little bit of clotrimazole on. It'll clear up just fine, just like any other yeasty diaper rash.
You can also see this in older kids or adults, especially if they're uncircumcised. So it's usually a problem problem in kids, it's because of the diaper, but in adults, it can be just because of being uncircumcised. And you can not just have, you can just have the glands infected, or you could just have the foreskin infected, but the treatment's the same. I will sometimes even add a barrier, like a Desitin cream, and have them mix that clotrimazole together to get a little barrier, to get a little antifungal, and I'll even do a little topical agent, especially if they have, or a hydrocortisone topical as well, just to, if they have a little bit of swelling that's causing significant pain, just to decrease that inflammation as we're getting the yeast infection under control.
Yeah. And it's almost always going to be candidol, which one of the other things that might be linked with this is this may be the first presentation of something like diabetes. So keep that in mind if they've suddenly got balanitis and they've never had that issue before. Now, the foreskin itself can, if you have repeated episodes of balanitis, can start to scar down and can form phimosis. So we're going to make a distinction between phimosis and paraphimosis. Phimosis, not dangerous. Paraphimosis, dangerous. So phimosis is going to be the turtleneck that just doesn't quite fit. You just can't get it over your head. And generally, it's not an issue. They'll treat with manual traction, shall we say, as the child gets older. Or sometimes they'll treat with some topical steroid medicine or hormone medicine to try to make the tissue a bit thinner. Usually, it's not going to cause much issue until it becomes too tight. As long as the patient can pee through an opening, you're fine. When it becomes too tight, then you run into the issue that I had with a post-obstructive uropathy. And those kids need a dorsal slit. Those adults need a dorsal slit. They need to come to a urologist and have that opened up so that they can relieve their obstruction. So paraphimosis is going to be the emergency. And paraphimosis is going to be that you pulled the turtleneck down and it was too tight, and you probably shouldn't have because now you're choking. You're literally choking off the head of the penis. The foreskin is pulled all the way retracted and then left retracted for an extended period of time. That leads to poor blood flow, edema of the glands, which is kind of the, you know, end organ at that stage. You can't get blood flow back, and you get this hyperemic swollen glands that just gets worse and worse and propagates itself.
And since you're getting a compartment syndrome of the distal penis, right, it's just that cycle that goes, and so your job is to try to stop this from happening, and the only way you're going to be able to do that is to get that foreskin off of the neck behind the glands. You need to either get it down and basically bring it down by smashing the glands of the penis, and I don't know what you've done with this, Aaron. I mean, it's a manual, just squeezing the head of the glands and making it as small as possible and trying to pull the foreskin over.
Yeah.
Not comfortable.
Manual traction works the best.
You can do a dorsal block for these patients, which is very, very kind. You can use sugar as an osmotic agent, which more than anything gives you use for those sugar packets in the nutrition room.
Is this what Def Leppard was singing about?
Possibly. You can ask Jenny Plitt. Her and I have a great story about this with a patient, and it earned her a few nicknames for quite a while.
Nice.
We had a patient, the urologist came in, he puts on one glove, because that's all you need, and then grabs and squeezes as hard as he can, and begins to inform the patient that, I'm going to do what we can. If we can't get this down, you're going to have to go back to the OR for the ultimate definitive treatment, which is a circumcision. Do you have any questions? And the patient says, can you let go? And the urologist says, no. And the patient goes, then will you stop making eye contact with me?
I'm guessing this wasn't a kid.
No, this wasn't. This poor guy. Anyway, so that's essentially what you can do with for paraphimosis. You got to get it over, but the end game is a circumcision. Similarly, we talked about compartment syndromes and poor flow. We'll talk about priapism. So if it's been longer than 4 hours, call someone.
do what you need to do. And there's two causes, right? There's a high flow priapism and there's a low flow priapism. And so the most common is a low flow state. And this is usually what we see is someone came in and they have that erection and it will not go away. And this can, you know, you can see there's some predisposing conditions for this. So people with sickle cell disease, I think diabetics can cause it. If you've had problems with, if they put in like prostatic pumps or if they've had other issues or just having it before will do it. And medications can sometimes do this as well.
I've seen this quite a bit with trazodone, actually.
Trazodone, I think a lot of the anti-psychotic meds and some of the anticholinergics are the ones that people have done. And so, and the high flow is a trauma, it's a straddle injury. So those are usually not as firm. The glands in the penis is not as firm, but it's, you know, the kid was basically showing off and tried to ride down that pole and rode down that pole, but in between his legs, and it did not feel good, and came in and didn't want to tell his mom about his mild erection that he has from trauma. So two different mechanisms, being low flow the most common.
Yeah, the high flow is going to be the spinal cord injury that leads to loss of your sympathetic tone. You just have this pure, unrestricted blood flow. The low flow is going to be the more serious. This is the potentially dangerous one that causes ischemia. You can tell the difference between these two if you're unsure by doing a PBG, a penile blood gas, to determine how it is. I sent one time on a patient.
Does respiratory do this?
I sent it to the blood gas lab, and they called me and said, is this patient alive? The pH was like 6.2 or, I don't know, something. Anyway, so that can be confirmatory. But the treatment for these is also urology immediately has to know about these because this is the low-flow priapisms are potentially penile-threatening. So supportive care, you can try ice packs. You can, if they're sickle cell patients, you may need to consider a transfusion, which can help. You can try to aspirate the corpus cavernosum and just suck the blood out, or you can do some phenylephrine to try to increase the SVR and push stuff around so that it's not all sitting there congregating. You could try tributyline orally, but sometimes they just end up needing to go to the OR. Right. And the risk of these is erectile dysfunction. So this goes with our emergency definition of life, limb, sight, and fertility threatening illnesses that we need to try to find. Yeah. In the high flow, you just kind of treat the underlying issue.
Yeah, sometimes people, the urologist may ask for Sudafed. Really, not a lot of those work. I mean, sometimes they work, but usually you're going to do an irrigation is what it ends up going. You try the tributyline, you try the phenylephrine injections, you do a dorsal penile block. You'll talk about aspiration at the 10 and 2 o'clock positions, and you aspirate out this chocolatey-looking blood. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to irrigate it, and so you'll have to aspirate multiple times, irrigate it, and that's what the urologists are going to do. They're going to flush it out. If they can't do it, like you said, then they're going to go to the operating room.
Penile fractures are fun to talk about, but they're not fun to have.
It's a sad penis. And it's, you know, it's just a tear of the fascia. So it's a tear of the fascia from some trauma, usually from an erect penis of some kind. And you'll get bruising on one side. You can feel the deficit sometimes. You could ultrasound this. I've ultrasounded one at the bedside and seen the tear of the fascia, just like looking at an Achilles tendon tear. Same kind of process. But urologists do want to be consulted for these because if you can repair that fascia, it can save the patient from, say, scarring or problems with erections in the future. So urologists will most times repair these.
Okay. So the same way women can get pelvic inflammatory disease, epididymitis or chitis is in PID for men. It goes up the tract and will cause pretty significant pain, swelling, inflammation. And this is also in men less than than 35 more likely to be chlamydia and gonorrhea versus an older man going to be E. coli. In prepubescent boys, you think about more gram-negative UTI kinds of things if they've got those symptoms. But there are other structural things that can cause this in these boys as well. If you've got a swollen testicle, you can actually palpate the testicle itself, and then the epididymis is right above it, which epididymis, you know what it means?
Next to the twins.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense now.
Makes total sense.
You can share that with the next patient you have when you're examining his epididymis.
I like it.
Hey, by the way, do you know what this means? You can have something called prensine, which is where you elevate the scrotum, and it's not hanging anymore, so there's no stress on the epididymis, and it feels a little bit better. So pretty much, when I have scrotal pain in a man, it's one of the easiest. Well, first of all, when I have scrotal pain in a man, it's a lot easier than scrotal pain in a woman.
Yeah.
When I've got a chief complaint of testicular pain, that's one of the easiest cases for me to take care of, because in the waiting room, I've already ordered their urine and ultrasound because there's no other workup for it. And then they get back and I look at it and see how bad it is, if it's something I need to take care of right now. And I'm almost always going to get a diagnosis. It's actually very satisfying. I would be more than happy to run like the testicular ER and just, yep, keep moving through.
Balls of plenty for you, Aaron.
With epididymitis or chitis, in younger kids, you can think of viral symptoms or syndromes as well. Some of the Coxsackie viruses will do this. Mumps used to be the big one. If they're unvaccinated, you could consider maybe it's mumps causing the orchitis, but it's almost always going to be something more bacterial. The one time where that may not be the case is in testicular torsion. So this was something I learned from Dr. Adhikari, that we'll often get back the ultrasound reads that show a hyperemic testicle and epididymis, consistent with epididymo orchitis. And it'll be in like an 11-year-old or an 8-year-old or, you know, someone that's kind of young for that. And what Shrikar says, that this is actually a manifestation of the testicle torsing and becoming ischemic, causing pain, causing them to come to the ER, and then by the time they get there, it detorses and they get a reperfusion injury of the testicle. So that hyperemia is not infection or inflammation, it's hyperemia because the testicle has essentially been choking. So that's something else to consider for these patients, is could this have been a torsion detorsion if they've got a stone cold normal urinalysis and signs of epididymo orchitis.
Yeah. So an epididymo orchitis, like Aaron's describing in the ultrasound, will be hyperemic. So you'll see increased blood flow, as opposed to a torsion ultrasound. You may see, hey, I don't see any blood flow on this side. Other things, you know, this is, you know, he mentioned infectious causes too, and we think a lot of times bacterial, but we're starting to see as people, you know, this is affecting a wide variety of men, different ages. There's a lot of idiopathic epididymitis and orchitis, probably some virus, whether it's Coxsackie or reactivation or who knows what. And so it used to be just Cipro would be the main treatment for these. Some urologists are even now going to doxycycline just for some maybe anti-inflammatory component of the antibiotic, still covering the same bacterial profile, but they're finding that some of their cure rates are better, maybe because of an anti-inflammatory. We mentioned the prensine helping. Also, part of your treatment for these patients is going to be some scrotal support. So you don't tell them to wear boxers when they go home. Get the tightest jock strap, 3 sizes smaller. Put that baby on. Take your medicines. Ice them. And stay away from the ladies.
Now, if you've got actual testicular torsion, some of the things you'll see on exam that's a little different, especially if you're on the in-training exam or the board exam, not on your true physical exam, you'll see a high-riding testicle, which basically means that the testicle's twisted enough on the spermatic cord and stalk that it started to rise up a little bit. If you've ever done that with like a necklace or something with a pendant on it, and you keep twisting it enough and it'll start to twist up and raise up. You may have loss of the cream aceteric reflex, which is, it's got to be, that should have been named after somebody, because there's got to be a story behind finding the cream aceteric reflex. Prensine does not work in these patients generally because it's an ischemic testicle. It's a heart attack of the testicle. And so elevating it isn't going to take the pressure off. It's still just going to hurt. And then these are emergencies. These are ones that if you suspect it, you call urology in, you send them to ultrasound. These patients need to go to the OR to get their testicle detorched. If you are in a place where you can't get them quickly, then you can attempt manual detorsion. Have you ever done this?
I have. A couple times I've had no success with it, but I try it and I usually am telling the urologist I am doing it. If they say, no, don't touch it, I'm coming in. Okay, fine, I don't touch it.
It's one of those nice things to get someone to hurry up of like, hey, I'm going to do your job for you. You better hurry up.
Right.
You better mess it up. And when you do that, it's you grab and you go medial to lateral. It's opening the book. So you're going to grab the testicle and go from medial aspect twisting to lateral aspect. And that's about 70 to 80% of testicular torsions. The torsion is going to go lateral to medial, so you twist it medial to lateral to untwist it. What I've heard before is, well, if they start screaming, then stop, because you're probably going the wrong way. I haven't done it where they weren't screaming, even after 100 of fentanyl and, you know, whatever else. Like, that hurts. And I've also never had a successful one.
The other finding they may mention on the board is a bell clapper deformity or a horizontal lie. That's probably what they're not going to say. The patient has a bell clapper deformity. They're going to say a horizontal lie, meaning the poles of the testes are going from one leg to the other, as opposed to an anterior-posterior direction. And so with these, and when you have a urology or ultrasound as your first option, the first in real life, it's always ultrasound because the urologist won't come in. In the boards, you're going to be call urology. Don't say, oh, I'm going to order the ultrasound, then I'm going to call urology. That will be wrong on the boards.
Right. They want to know that you've identified it clinically and that you've gotten the ball rolling for the urologist to come in. And oftentimes what will happen here is the urologist will meet them in ultrasound if they're really concerned. The onset of this is of a true testicular torsion is going to be different than epididymal orchitis. Torsion is going to be quick. It's going to be very common in newborns. It's going to be very common in teenagers. And then you reach kind of another peak around 40s to 50s or so. And it's minimal trauma. It's getting out of the car and sending one of those things spinning until you start to get torsion. So it's an acute onset versus epididymal orchitis, which is usually over hours to
a couple days even. Yeah, and note with the patients that Aaron's describing, the baby is maybe just an unconsolable baby. That may be the predicting thing that you're looking at. The teenager, maybe he got in the car, was playing basketball with friends, no big thing, and then all of a sudden he had pain. Something where it wasn't a major trauma, but he was just doing a daily activity. And then the older patients, again, maybe it's a hazy history that came in with his wife, not sure what happened. So you'll take the history, can definitely, they can all present a little bit differently, but it's an acute process. This is not like they had this for 4 days. If it's a torsion at that point, it doesn't matter whether you call the urologist or get the ultrasound.
Let's talk about testicular masses. So if you've got someone comes in with a swollen scrotum, you think about what we've already talked about with testicular torsion or epididymitis. But there are generally going to be something else that we'll find. Usually it'll be something innocuous that doesn't really cause much trouble. So the most common one I see is a hydrocele, especially in kids. It's just a little fluid collection. You can take your pen light and put it behind the scrotum and make a little scrotal lantern there, and then you want to wipe down that pen light really well. But that transillumination can help make people feel better, help the family feel better. I still usually end up getting ultrasounds because I ordered it in triage. But that hydrocele is generally supportive, and you know it can be taken care of at the patient's leisure. So tumor is what we're always concerned about. We don't want it to be a tumor. We don't want it to be a seminoma, which is the most common one. These are going to be firm. They're generally not painful. Hydrocele can be firm sometimes and generally aren't painful. So be hoping for Hydrocele when you get these patients that come in. But the varicocele is sometimes a little more painful. It's that bag of worms examination. And then the last one being a torsion of the appendage of the testicle. So there's a little thing that's like hanging off the testicle that can also twist, and it gives you this blue dot sign. So if they show you a testicle with a blue dot, that's a torsed testicular appendage, and there's nothing to do about it. Treat with NSAIDs, and then again, if it's still causing pain, they can go to the urologist and have it zapped off there if they want to. All right, should we end this with Fournier's gangrene?
Oh, that's the end of all ends.
That is the end. You're getting into a whole other system there. This is the place no one wants to look, and we have to. This is your diabetic patient almost always, or a morbidly obese patient with very poor hygiene, and they come in sick, and you have to look everywhere to see where their source is, and generally this is going to be it. Last one I saw looked like a Halloween pumpkin in December. I mean, it was just gross looking.
Yeah, and especially when you're starting to see that end skin change, you know you're at the end, right? So the beginning of any necrotizing infection is going to be pain out of proportion without skin changes, eventually showing swelling of the skin, progressing to redness, and maybe some blebs and darkening, especially if it's like a clot, black-filled bleb all over the scrotum. So it's important in your older male patients, especially if they're diabetic or have end-stage liver disease or end-stage kidney disease, on dialysis, take off their underwear, put them in a gown, flip open the gown, look under the scrotum, look at the penis. And you really need to look under the scrotum. It's not just the penis, like, oh, I can see the penis. It can start posterior, and really that's where you're going to pick it up first. So it's but this is a real disease process that is not so uncommon. I mean, you see this.
I think all of you will see this.
And it will be on the boards. Like, this is going to be on the boards. Some iteration of Fournier's or complications therein will be on the boards.
So do you give them antibiotics? Sure. Do you treat their sepsis with fluids? Yeah, of course. The answer is going to be get them to the OR for debridement, because it's like an iceberg. The little bit you see is nothing compared to all the dead gangrenous tissue that's underneath. I mean, this will take over someone in a matter of hours, and they'll be dead. So we have to find these. We can't let these go.
And you're going to call the board answer, I think, would be call the urologist first. General surgery in real life may be involved, but the urologist is going to do the dissection and usually open up the whole scrotal sac, and these patients then will be filleted with their testicles and cords, basically laying out for serial debridement. So the testicles usually don't get involved. It's those fascial planes, and it may extend up into the abdomen or even up into the chest or farther. So that's why down the thighs. So the general surgeon will have to be involved too. But like Aaron said, fluids, surgery, antibiotics, and then you may have to treat their complications. So this may be the diabetic in DKA. They may ask you something about what else. They're like, oh, you've called surgery, you've given antibiotics and fluid. What else do you want to do? So just know that these patients aren't just the Fourniers. There's probably other systems involved. Maybe even a kidney injury. Oh, we've taken it back up to the kidney.
Full circle.
Wow.
Fantastic. All right. Well, good luck on the end training exam. Join us next month when we talk about flu. Study hard and do great.
You'll do great. See ya.